Welcome, Deep Divers. Today, we're diving into a really critical topic, the ongoing discussion, you know, the sometimes very heated discussion around critical race theory, especially within American education.
And it's vital link, yeah, to intercultural communication. That's key.
Exactly. So our mission here really is to unpack the source material. We want to understand what critical race theory actually is, why it's become such a, well, a flashpoint. And crucially, what perspectives our sources offer for navigating these, let's face it, complex conversations.
That's right. And it's important to stress, this isn't just about some abstract theory you'd only find in academia.
No.
It's about understanding a concept with very real, tangible implications for society. Especially right now, with racial tensions being quite high.
Absolutely.
The material we looked at really emphasizes examining multiple perspectives, the goal being to foster a deeper understanding, which, well, it feels more critical than ever if we want to bridge some of these divides.
Yeah, for sure. And as we try to cut through some of the noise today, you can expect some surprising insights, some practical ideas too.
Yeah, actionable stuff.
Concrete actions proposed in our source material to genuinely improve intercultural communication. So let's get right to the core of it. Okay, let's try and unpack critical race theory itself. I know our audience has a baseline understanding, but it's worth really honing in on the core premise.
Definitely.
The material we examined frames CRT, fundamentally, as holding that racism isn't just about individual prejudice, right?
Right. It's seen as a social construct.
A social construct deeply embedded in, say, legal systems, academic institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And this construct, the theory suggests, was largely created to, well, advance the needs and interests of white people.
And systemically holding back people of color.
Particularly African Americans, yeah, perpetuating these social, economic, political inequalities.
It's interesting, too, tracing its origins. I mean, the term itself, critical race theory, was officially introduced in 1989. But its intellectual roots, they go back much further, back to the 1960s, really.
The civil rights movement era.
Exactly. It emerged from that movement as scholars started looking critically at why racial inequality persisted, even after those landmark legal victories, you know. Why were things still so unequal?
That context really helps frame it. Okay, so diving deeper into some specifics, the tenets. Our source highlights that the very idea of race, it's seen not as biological reality.
No, not biological.
But as a, and I'm quoting here, socially constructed category based on differences in appearance that has been used to create hierarchies that privilege some and disadvantage others.
And building right on that, a core idea is that racism isn't some rare event. It's a common, almost everyday occurrence for people of color across all sorts of institutional systems.
Right.
And the material points out a pretty critical perspective here, that legal victories or even setbacks often end up serving dominant white groups.
Mm.
And even sometimes large-scale improvements might be viewed as, well, performative.
Performative, like just for show.
Yeah, actions taken more for appearance than for genuine systemic change.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can actually cause more damage by creating this false sense of progress.
That makes sense. Okay, another key tenet mentioned is differential racialization.
Mm.
This is described as the practice of selectively assigning identities to people of color, often kind of lumping them together using stereotypes.
Right, which is significant because it can just erase diverse experiences,
yeah.
Right? It reinforces harmful narratives, especially when it comes to policy or how things are portrayed in the media.
Yeah, homogenizing complex groups.
And then there's perhaps one of the most widely discussed tenets, the one that's really powerful for understanding individual experiences.
You mean intersectionality.
Exactly, intersectionality.
Yeah.
It came out of CRT, and it basically highlights that, look, no single person can be properly understood by just one identity.
Okay.
People have these overlapping identities. You might be, say, a black woman or a queer Latinx person. Intersectionality explains how these multiple identities all experience racism and systemic prejudice. But in unique, compounded ways.
Yeah.
You can't just look at race or gender or sexuality in separate boxes.
It's the intersection that matters. Okay, so with that foundation, let's shift to the current controversy. Because there is a lot of controversy.
Oh, definitely.
Our source highlights this movement, and it seems to be gaining momentum fast, especially among conservatives, to eliminate the teaching of CRT.
Right. We're seeing actual bans in several states now. Even in schools that, well, weren't actually teaching it in the first place or had no plans to.
Which is interesting in itself.
Yeah, and this pushback, it's significant because it's happening, as the source puts it, at a tumultuous time in the country.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing these heightened racial tensions where Ironically, maybe, intercultural communication isn't always as welcomed as you might hope.
Mm-hmm.
It really reflects a deeper struggle over how we even talk about race and history.
And a very common argument, one you hear a lot against CRT, and our material addresses this, is the claim that it promotes indoctrination.
Yes, or that it unfairly labels all white people as bigots. But the research we looked at, it directly refutes that. It says, quote, that is not true.
Okay.
The theory doesn't suggest that all white people are racist, but it does challenge the idea that America is not a systemically racist country with a long line of damage in its wake.
So that raises a really important question then, doesn't it? If it's not about blaming individuals, then what is the core disagreement? What's driving this fierce opposition? It seems like maybe it's a discomfort with that very idea of systemic critique.
I think that's a huge part of it. It shifts a focus, doesn't it? Away from individual feelings or intentions towards these larger structures.
Which is a much tougher conversation.
Absolutely.
Oh.
And necessary, perhaps. The material also brings up the experience of David E. Kirkland.
Ah, yes.
He recognized the need for diversity, but still encountered, his words, significant pushback on critical race theory, even though he believes it's, quote, necessary in moving the country forward.
That really underscores the depth of this ideological divide we're seeing. So, okay, given this intense backdrop, this controversy, what do we actually do? Does the source offer ways forward?
It does. It moves from the critique towards offering some concrete solutions. It outlines three best practices, really designed to improve communication and understanding, especially aimed at engaging those who might oppose CRT. And it's crucial, the source says, that these three are implemented together. They're not isolated fixes.
Got it. All three working in concert. What's the first one?
The first solution proposed is install diverse leadership from local to national.
Okay, diverse leadership.
Yeah, the material really emphasizes the need for a fundamental overhaul in institutional leadership, making sure it actually reflects the country's diverse population.
And especially in areas most affected by systemic racism.
Exactly. Places like education, local community groups, government offices, housing, assistance, law enforcement. The argument presented is that the entire institutional structure in the U.S. has been, quote, designed to be inherently racist.
Wow. Designed to be inherently racist? That's a strong claim.
It is. And so diverse leadership is seen as essential for any real systemic change.
The source author included a personal example, right? About their manager.
Yes, a really powerful one. Their manager made deliberate efforts to diversify what had been an all-white senior citizen dean's council at an institution.
And the point was?
It highlights just how important it is for students, for instance, to see themselves reflected in leadership, to be able to connect their own intersecting identities to the people in charge. It builds trust, shows the possibilities.
That makes a lot of sense. Representation matters.
It does. And the source talks about the potential ripple effect this kind of diversity could have, especially on systems like education, legal, judicial systems that, as the source points out, can facilitate the mass incarceration of people of color and the poor.
So it's not just about faces, it's about changing outcomes.
Precisely. And beyond just representation, the material even suggests practical steps, like mentorship programs, connecting students and parents with diverse leaders, offering scholarships, networking, really cultivating new leadership from within communities.
Okay, so diverse leadership is number one. What's the second solution?
Second solution, run an online social media campaign to educate and encourage engagement.
Ah, taking it online.
Right. Envisioned as a, quote, fully funded online campaign led by diverse artists, leaders, thinkers.
And who's the main audience for this?
Primarily younger generations. Yeah. They're described in the source as being keenly aware of the disparities and, you know, often already very active online.
Makes sense. So what would this campaign actually do?
Well, it could serve as an umbrella, really, for lots of different initiatives.
Like what?
Like sharing personal stories, getting people of color, people from diverse cultures to share their experiences, finding common ground maybe through focusing on intersectionality or cultural heritage.
Humanizing the issues.
Exactly. It also proposes things like a mural project. Artists interpreting these stories, especially from less privileged areas, using art to foster shared experiences and dialogue.
That's interesting. And wasn't there something about food?
Yes. That was a really interesting part. The source suggests that something as simple as sharing food, exchanging family recipes, can organically deepen relationships.
Breaking bread together.
Yeah. It fosters intercultural understanding because, well, food is universal, right? It can break down barriers, shift the focus from maybe a tense intellectual debate to just a shared human experience.
Nonverbal communication.
Right. The source actually argues that this kind of nonverbal connection can sometimes be even more meaningful than verbal communication.
Huh. I can see that. What else for the online campaign?
It also mentions things like online musical performances, theater productions, things that could potentially even lead to physical gatherings down the line, strengthening local community connections.
Okay, an online campaign sounds promising, but there's a major hurdle, right? The source mentions the digital divide.
Absolutely, that's a critical challenge. There's this huge gap in internet access.
And it doesn't affect everyone equally.
No. It disproportionately affects people of color, but also, importantly, poor white families, often in traditionally conservative states.
We definitely saw that highlighted during the pandemic with remote learning.
Exactly. It was really exacerbated then.
Yeah.
So any online campaign has to grapple with that reality, the need for equitable access if it's truly going to reach everyone and succeed. And so that brings us to the third and final solution proposed in the source material.
What is it?
Implement inclusive academic curriculum focused on current times.
Ah, curriculum changes. This sounds like it gets right back to the heart of the CRT debate.
It does. It's presented as needing a robust, comprehensive academic curriculum, one that promotes diversity enrichment by teaching CRT tenets, but through an, quote, updated lens.
Updated lens. What does that mean exactly? The source brings in Kimberly Crenshaw here, right? One of the foundational scholars of CRT.
Yes, and she offers this really powerful perspective. She says CRT is not a noun, but a verb.
Not a noun, but a verb, meaning?
Meaning it's an evolving and malleable practice. It's not static. Crenshaw critiques how the social construction of race and institutionalized racism work together to perpetuate what she calls a racial caste system.
A caste system.
Yeah.
Like locking people into tiers based on race.
Essentially, yeah. A system where your social mobility is significantly limited by racial lines, echoing historical caste systems, it relegates people of color to lower tiers.
And Crenshaw connects this directly to the present day.
Absolutely. She states very clearly that CRT acknowledges that racism is, quote, not a bygone relic of the past.
It's not over.
No. The legacy of slavery, segregation, second-class citizenship, it continues, she argues, to permeate the social fabric of this nation. It's current and moves forward with us as a nation, deepening the wounds and keeping them fresh.
That's a really powerful way to put it. It's not just history, it's ongoing.
Exactly. And that's where a lot of the public debate seems to miss the mark, according to this perspective. It's about understanding that invisible architecture of systemic power that's still operating.
And just to reiterate, because it's a common flashpoint, the material we reviewed insists, again here, that this curriculum isn't about indoctrination.
Correct.
Or labeling all white people as bigots. Its core aim, the source states, is to challenge the idea that America is not a systemically racist country.
It's about asking those uncomfortable questions.
Yeah.
To get to a more complete, more honest understanding of the nation's past. And, crucially, its present.
Right.
Now, the source does add a note of caution, a pragmatic one. These solutions, diverse leadership, the online campaign, the curriculum, they won't magically end racism overnight.
Of course not.
But they can be highly effective, it suggests, under the right leadership and with a real collective commitment.
So wrapping this up, what does this all mean for you, our listener, trying to make sense of this? The material we've dug into, it highlights what seems like a crucial finding, a kind of collective lack of intercultural communication skills across the board. And this deficit, it often leads us to just eliminate uncomfortable subjects, avoid them rather than actually engaging to resolve the conflict or misunderstanding.
That really resonates. And this deep dive, it makes it pretty clear that, as the source puts it, lives continue to hang in the balance as long as we don't make that collective effort, an effort to understand each other beyond these conditioned stereotypes we all carry.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a call for leaders, but maybe for all of us, really, to listen actively and maybe harder still, to accept the parts that they don't care for. That acceptance seems key for any real breakthroughs in how we relate across cultures and different backgrounds.
So we've looked at some comprehensive definitions. We've delved into the intense controversy around critical race theory.
We definitely did that.
And we've outlined these three practical pathways that our source proposes to try and bridge understanding and improve communication.
And remember, as the source concludes, knowledge really is power. Especially knowledge about the forces shaping our society, even the uncomfortable ones.
The hope expressed in the material is that these ideas, if implemented thoughtfully, could genuinely help bridge some divides. Empower people, all races, all cultures, to communicate more effectively. For the good of the whole country, really.
So maybe something to consider as you go about your week is this. How can you personally actively engage with uncomfortable truths? Maybe in your own conversations, your own interactions. How can you foster genuine understanding, contribute to a more inclusive society rather than letting silence or avoidance, deepen the wounds?